podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Ready. Play.
Well, hello everybody, welcome to ATP Weekly for this week. Of course, there's one usual suspect, if you want to call him, absent, and I'll be, I don't know, taking his place for this week. I have with me, as always, Damien. How are you doing, Damien?
Cool. I'm ready to talk Indian Wells, sort of close out this chapter in the tennis season. And right. Yeah, the Oscar award, John, will not be going to you. Sorry. There will be better short movies. However, yeah, the cinematic music, yeah, it gets you going for the ATP Weekly for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's that iMovie template, you know, it's been there for years. But yeah, pretty nostalgic for sure. But anyway, let's get to talking about Indian Wells, of course. We'll cover this storyline by storyline. You know, first and foremost, Carlos Alcaraz back in the winner's circle. Breaking that cold spell from winning Wimbledon, making just one final, and now he's defended his crown at Indian Wells. And would you say that he's back now?
Yeah, I mean, we can say that. I mean, was he ever really gone is also another question that one could probably pose. He's had some excellent matches since Wimbledon. I honestly, like, if we're talking about the beginning of his slump, I like to say post-US Open, because obviously Cincinnati, he almost wins it. He plays a ridiculous set, that decider, which he loses, but still. There's also, of course, the US Open, which is perfectly fine. Like, you know, losing in the semifinals, of course, maybe it wasn't what he expected. But still, like, losing to Medvedev on a hard court in the semifinals of a major is not a bad run at all. So if there was a slump, it was post-US Open rather than that. Definitely, you know, sort of ahead of the golden swing, ahead of him playing Buenos Aires, Rio, it kind of felt like he needs to get, like, a title, a massive result somewhere in order to, like, get him, you know, restarted. He didn't get that, of course, and that ankle roll could have been really meaningful in Rio, because if that actually hampered his Indian Wells chances, then yeah, then that's a big hit for the rest of the season for him, really, given that this is one of his favorite courts. This is where he should be succeeding. This is where he should be, you know, the main favorite going forwards for the foreseeable future as well. So in many ways, in more ways than one, this is a massive win for him. We'll see how he sort of maintains that. Obviously, Miami, there's like a lot less pressure now because, well, even if he loses somewhere, he's won Indian Wells. Who cares? And it's the clay coming. So especially on like a mental level, confidence wise, and also we're going to be talking about this probably maybe in more detail, but like in regards to who he beat and how he did it as well. Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely massive, and it should fire him up for the rest of the year for sure.
Right. Yeah, of course. When I meant when I asked whether he's back or not, you know, for sorry, the standard that he set over the last couple of years, of course, you know, making just one final, like you said, U.S. Open was not bad either. You know, he Medvedev played one of his best matches at Grand Slam level, of course, and you know, former champion, no shame losing there. But of course, he had a spell of losing relatively early at Masters events. Turin was sort of disappointing. You know, the way it ended. Okay, sure. You know, he bounced back and made the semifinals, but you know, losing quite comfortably to Djokovic, I think for him that would have been disappointing for sure. And then Australian Open, you know, he was playing well until the quarterfinal. You know, in my opinion, he dropped a stinker in that quarters, and you know, he came back into the match in the dying embers of it, and it was too late. And then, like you mentioned, in Rio, of course, before that Buenos Aires, he lost to Jarry in the semis, and then in Rio. There was that concerning ankle roll that took place. So there were a lot of question marks, but he mentioned that, yeah, he should be fine for the Netflix slam and, of course, the Sunshine Double. So, yeah, all of that is aside now. And Carlos Alcaraz has, you know, stamped his authority again on the tour, if you will, winning another big title, his fifth Masters 1000 title. Then, of course, let's talk about the final itself. It was a repeat of last year's final. Obviously, the first set could have pretty much gone either way. Medvedev had the break early on, and then the tiebreaker, they were 5-all. And I think, yeah, there was a 15-30 moment as well for Medvedev at 5-4 in the first set, which, of course, Carlos served his way out of trouble there pretty comfortably. But, yeah, so do you think the scoreline has more to do with Medvedev changing up his tactics compared to last year? Like, did he do his homework from the beatdown that he received last year, or did it have more to do with, you know, quite a few unforced errors from Alcaraz in the first set?
Yeah, the unforced errors weren't, you know, just there. Like, they also happened because of what the opponent is doing. And yeah, I think Daniil, despite this being a 6-7-1-6 loss, and maybe the last few games were a bit of a throwaway, like he wasn't fully in it anymore. But despite losing in straights, he actually kind of impressed me because he made sure that this was not going to be yet another 2023 final. Like, he made sure that this was going to be different, that he was going to use some of that very aggressive court positioning that we saw at the Australian Open when he was very tired. And after all, this is what we were sort of all advocating for after that Australian Open, that, of course, this is never going to be his primary way to play the game. How he played in the first two sets against Sinner, or how he played against Zverev from two sets to lockdown. And it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be, because that would take away from a lot of his other assets. But for him to just have this as a potential way of playing if it's necessary, if it's convenient, if it's required. So I did definitely enjoy how he did not surrender the usual advantages to Alcaraz, like, you know, the serve and volleying, the drop shots. Like, he just made it a lot tougher for Carlos to execute these things that usually just give him 3 points against Medvedev. Of course, it's not that they weren't there in the match. Like, you know, Alcaraz still got a few points from both, still was able to expose the court positioning sometimes when Medvedev got a little too passive. But at least Daniil required a very high standard from him, which it didn't really feel like that in Indian Wells 2023. In 2023, it was just like Alcaraz came out and, yeah, like, whatever he played, he would have won that match. And this time, it wasn't quite like that. And yeah, the first set could have gone very close. It kind of reminded me that first set of the US Open semi, because that was a match where, like, Medvedev is just serving great. He gets to 3-all in the tiebreak, and suddenly Carlos goes away for a few points with his shot selection, and the match is kind of done. And here, when he lost that 5-2 lead in the tiebreak, like, we weren't far away from something like that. But obviously, he wins the next 2 points from 5-all, which was extremely crucial. After that, the match is kind of over for his favor. But yeah, I mean, that was some real resistance from Medvedev. That was some real intent and idea for this match, which he didn't really have at Indian Wells, which he didn't really have at Wimbledon. So I guess that only makes the matchup sort of going forwards, it does make it more interesting. And he definitely made it so that even though we all considered the Alcaraz-Sinner semi to be like practically a final, Medvedev made it so that it wasn't just, yeah, okay, Alcaraz is just winning this, no doubt. It wasn't the women's final, let's say that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one of his resolutions at the beginning of the season was that he's going to improve on his temperament. He's, you know, going to fight for every point. He's not just going to fade away in matches. He did show quite a bit of that. The Australian Open, two wins from two sets down and 2 points away from losing also there. And same here in Indian Wells. Again, that match against Tommy Paul, you know, Paul could have run away with it. Of course, he rolled his ankle at the worst moment possible, but still, he very much could have lost there. Even against Korda, after losing that second set, you know, had a break advantage multiple times, ended up losing. Korda played a really good game. And I thought, okay, maybe this could be like the way he lost in 2021 against Dimitrov from the set in two breaks up. But no, he's not going away. I mean, sure, he does show frustration. He does show anger towards his box or, you know, to the chair umpire or whoever. But he, you know, he resets. He battles through. He tries to problem solve his way out of trouble, if you will. But yeah, so I guess for him, as much as it's disappointing to lose yet another final, there's a lot of positives for him to take from this tournament and Australian Open, especially since considering this tournament and the draw that he had. I don't think many people gave him a chance to even make the semis or final, to be honest. He had Korda and Dimitrov and Holger. Yeah, of course, he met Holger in the quarterfinal. And yeah, we expected a Djokovic Medvedev semifinal if, you know, the draw played out the way it was supposed to. Yeah, exactly. But in any way, positive tournament for him moving forward. Of course, at some point, he's going to break that barrier and lift another title. So yeah, let's circle back to Djokovic, of course. Me personally, I'm not particularly shocked that he lost early, but what's more shocking is who he lost to. And obviously the manner in which he lost to, you know, because once he got that second set, I don't think people would have thought he was going to lose from there. So does this mean anything at all for Novak? Is he going to be concerned? Obviously he's not playing Miami, so he's making his intentions clear. He's targeting the clay season. As a result, the Olympics as well. So do you think this maybe gives the rest of the tour confidence that, you know, Djokovic is not invincible and that he's beatable?
Yeah, it's hard to me, for me, for now at least, to be fully like on the Djokovic is washed theme because, well, this is a guy who won three slams last year. He won the ATP Finals with, like, honestly, some of his strongest back-to-back performances that we've ever seen, Sinner and Alcaraz in the semis in the final. So to sort of go from that to already saying that he's done a month or two earlier, I do think that's a bit too quick. However, yeah, I mean, why did you even go to the States if that's kind of the result, right? I mean, he played two matches in Indian Wells. He withdraws out of Miami, which I don't really know if it's a decision I prefer. But, well, last few seasons haven't been too great for him on clay. Generally, slower courts as he's aged, as he's become the more aggressive version of his game, as he's like, yeah, serving much better now. Slow courts maybe aren't that suitable anymore. So, okay, he lost Indian Wells, yes, but, you know, there's going to be more of that on clay. And the last few years, we've kind of haven't been seen, like, of course, there were some other external factors, but like most of the time, we've only really seen him get into the top gear on clay by Roland Garros or like by Rome. So, maybe this time it's going to be very different. That's going to be probably very exciting to follow going forward. So there, this time that peak in the clay season happens earlier, where this starts, let's say, if not in Monte Carlo, then maybe in Madrid already or something like that. But yeah, it is kind of a worrisome beginning of the year for Djokovic for sure, in the sense that, for example, year-end number one right now, like, looks kind of far from him. We'll see. Obviously, I'm not ready to exclude him just yet. I'm not ready to write him off just yet. There's simply not been enough time. But yeah, it's a pretty rough start to the season, and it's one that makes you think whether he's going to be able to claim. Well, I'm not saying that he's not going to be able to claim like an ATP 1000 or something, but yeah, whether he's still going to be one of the main contenders for slams, especially for Alcaraz and Sinner improving so much. I mean, Sinner beating him in Australia obviously wasn't the best performance from Novak, but let's say Roland Garros, Alcaraz will be probably a big threat to him. Wimbledon, both of them, really. So, I mean, there's still a lot of uncertainty. But all in all, it's not this performance that kind of maybe tells you that something might be going wrong is the whole season, really, so far.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, where I'm coming from, it's based on Ray's tie from Wimbledon, when once he got the fifth set, we were like, there is no chance Alcaraz, or not no chance, 95 or 96% of the odds are in favor of Djokovic. So like, this guy's not going to lose a deciding set, especially on center court. But Alcaraz just thwarts all of that. He beats him for the first time, how many, 5 years in Wimbledon. And of course, okay, we were like, fine. You know, he was bound to have a loss like that. So many five-setters that he's played. He ends up on the winning side, law of averages. Then, yeah, I mean, after that, he has a really strong finish to the season, winning Cincinnati in the US Open, Paris-Bercy ATP Finals, and, you know, obviously he's beat some of the best players in the world across those tournaments, including Alcaraz and Sinner back-to-back in Turin, like you mentioned. Then comes Australia. Again, we don't know how to really assess that semifinal for Sinner, because we know that he's been playing some amazing tennis since Beijing last year. But this is, you know, a whole new ball game playing Novak Djokovic, you know, at the Australian Open and in a round he's never lost in before. And then, you know, yes, like you said, those Djokovic was off color for most of it, but, you know, Sinner play, it was a masterclass for him to win in four sets without facing a break point. That for sure. I mean, then I thought, okay, I mean, you can't, again, a one-off. He was due to drop a stinker like this at Grand Slams. Like, he keeps bringing his A game, or even A plus game to the latter stages of Slams. Doesn't happen. He gets steamrolled. Yeah, exactly. He did actually end up winning a set, as our producer points out. But yeah, and that again, even though he won that set, that's when people thought, okay, you know, is the comeback on? But no, you know, Sinner kept it together and he beat him. So it's been shown now that, you know, he's beatable. I mean, it's not like he was always beatable. You guys just didn't do it. But, you know, the signs are such that, of course, he's going to decline at some point. And it's, you know, better at 37 than earlier, of course, for Novak. But that, yeah, like I said, you know, before I ramble off too much, that is what I mentioned. Like, it's not that, you know, I think he's washed or I think his slam winning days are behind him. But the landscape is definitely more different in light of what's happened in the past few big tournaments and slams, especially. We should probably touch up on that little incident that he had with Luca Nardi. Of course, Twitter blew up, as always. You know, when Djokovic loses, Twitter is probably the worst place to be at. You have horrible takes on both sides, but just being objective here. Yeah, what do you think? Because do you think Nardi actually stopped, or even if he did stop and, you know, for a split second just stood there and he was continuing with the point, do you think Novak really had a leg to stand on when he argued with the umpire?
There wasn't really any point, but obviously I also have some sympathy for Novak in this case because, well, that's, you know, that happens. Like, you will not be able to assess the situation clearly if you're in the point. So it's perfectly fine that he was arguing for it. That's like something that no one can really criticize it for, I think. Because, yeah, I mean, he simply interpreted the situation differently. And that's fine. What I don't think was fine was bringing that up after the match, like instantly at the handshake. Like, this was a situation that happened an hour earlier. And, yeah, that's salty. You know, Djokovic is generally a gracious loser. There's definitely going to be more instances of that rather than him actually being like this. But yeah, this wasn't great. This was just kind of taking away the, you know, some of the joy from Nardi, I think. And that's obviously not ideal. But all in all, yeah, I don't think there was anything wrong in arguing, even if he didn't have a case. But there was, yeah, just to bring it up 1 hour later.
Yeah, I mean, there is entitled to due process, like talking to the umpire about it, that's fine. But it was obviously translated from Italian to English what he actually said to Nardi at the net. I felt for Nardi when you could see, oh, you know, I'm sorry. I thought, I mean, before I actually saw the translation of what was said, I thought Nardi initiated the apology for what had happened earlier, but turns out that wasn't the case. I mean, you know, Novak said, you know, that wasn't, Novak brought it up. You know, he said, you know, that wasn't correct, but bravo, well done. That was poor form, of course. There are no two ways about it. And like you said, it's kind of odd to see someone like Novak do it, because, you know, we've seen the way he has congratulated his opponents right after some of the most heartbreaking or difficult losses in his career. There were those two Olympics matches that he lost previously, last two editions. It was that calendar slam defeat to Daniil Medvedev. There was that RG final loss to Wawrinka. We can just go on. He's been super gracious, even though, you know, those were gut-wrenching defeats for him. But this, I mean, okay, you won this tournament five times. Okay, this guy's a kid who's looked up to you. He has a poster of you in his bedroom. Was that the right thing to do? I don't know. Maybe something else off court for Novak. It's, you know, not really keeping him in a happy place. I don't know, because he cited family as a reason for withdrawing from Miami. So I just wonder. But anyway, that's that. I don't think there's much to talk about it. We're in agreement. Novak shouldn't have brought it up at the net. Of course, there's one player who's I think almost always flies under the radar. He won a title earlier this year in Dallas, and he made the semifinals here. Tommy Paul. Of course, the usual co-host of this segment, if you will, ATP Weekly, Mario, put out this stat, which basically states that, you know, aside from Djokovic, Medvedev, Alcaraz, and Sinner, there's only one player who has made three or more semifinals at big events on hard courts over the past year, and that's Tommy Paul. So, you know, do you think that we could see something from him in Miami? Is he going to back it up, or is he just going to be a streaky player and, you know, one tournament here and there and rack up the points and stay in the top 15 time?
The new Karen Khachanov, if you may. that's what the stats reminds me of.
Not wrong, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, someone had to pick up the pieces. Of course, Tommy was a contender from the get-go, but you kind of weren't sure if maybe he's going to beat Mickelson right away. He did, and like did it very cleanly, actually, in the second round, which was kind of surprising given the recent Delray Beach meeting. And after that, I guess he was always one of the main contenders. He loves these courts too, has always done well. Obviously not semi-final well, but he's been like, you know, at least third round, at least a couple of wins basically every single time. So yeah, I mean, he was definitely one of like the, if not Djokovic, then who? He was probably, along with Casper Ruud, in that top quarter. He was probably one of the main contenders anyway. Oh, Hurkacz was there as well, I guess, but I forgot about him. But yeah, Hurkacz too, I suppose. And yeah, sort of going forwards, of course, he had a big chance to make the final. Which is something that we have to remember about. He gets that ankle roll, just like Alcaraz in Rio. He rolls his ankle a little bit here. Of course, he's able to continue, but he's not able to continue at 100%, really. So it does turn the match around quite a lot. Before that, he actually pulls off a pretty spectacular comeback in the second set. He definitely, like, yeah, just maxed out his abilities this week in a way, and was very close to making the final. I don't know if I would have thought of him as the favorite over Carlos. Probably not, despite the rivalry being pretty close. Mm-hmm. I think he, on this court, he probably wouldn't have too much of a shot against Alcaraz. But yeah, it's still a great run, still lots of progress at an event where we kind of expected it. As for Miami, it's very tough to say anything without the draw.
Yeah, it's also true. You know, a lot of talk about the next tournament without having the draw is mostly redundant, unless, you know, it is. Oh, is this? Do you think this player is ready to go for the next tournament for whatever reason? Like Jannik Sinner, for example. I think he fell on his wrist. I didn't watch that match, so I don't know what exactly happened. And you know,
yeah, he basically tried to chase down an Alcaraz volley. There was this point where there's a net court. Alcaraz tracks it down. He gets to the net, plays this lunging forehand volley, which barely bounces. And Sinner tries to track it down. He actually does. He puts it over the net, but Alcaraz has an easy put away into the open court because Sinner is on the ground. And he basically fell on his wrist. Now, was that very impactful? It's very hard to say. He was also grabbing his knee a few times in the first set.
That was after Alcaraz broke in the decider. Was that the point?
The knee was earlier, but the wrist was when Alcaraz broke. That was literally the point Alcaraz broke.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. That was literally the break point. So it's hard to say. We were talking about this on the Egan Carlos show with Vansh last night, that like this isn't really part of the post-match discussion, or at least it won't be for us. Like, similarly to Sinner Alcaraz in 2023 Miami, where like you don't really mention the cramps for Alcaraz because, well, it was still such a good battle, and like when you're talking about that win, you're mostly thinking about the whole Sunshine Double and, you know, Carlos winning in Indian Wells, Yannick in Miami, which makes sense conditions-wise. And you don't really bring it up as like one of the main things about the match, where, for example, you would for the Roland Garros semi between Alcaraz and Djokovic. Like, there you have to kind of mention the cramps right away because they are sort of how the match was won or lost. But the cramps, Miami, probably not. And here I also wouldn't really bring up either the wrist or the knee as something that made the match go like it did. But certainly after that breakpoint and after that fall, he didn't have a trainer visit or anything, but he did go on a pretty massive error streak. Yes.
Yeah, parallels between both matches, really. I mean, Carlos won the first set in Miami, lost 6-2 in the decider. Yannick wins the first set here, loses 6-2 in the decider. So maybe, yeah, I can see where you're getting at. I mean, neither injury really, you know, decided the outcome, if you will. But, right. So let's just hope, you know, there's nothing serious and that he's fit and healthy for Miami. Of course, you know, he suffered his first defeat of the season to Alcaraz. I want to really touch up on this before we move on to, you know, there are a few more players we speak about. You know, this is not just something fancy, but we have spoken about this also, I think. How much did the comparisons with 2011 annoy you in terms of the trajectory that Sinner took in terms of, yeah, sure, he won a Grand Slam. And that at the back of the previous season, he won Davis Cup, just like Djokovic, yes. And then he wins a 500 after the Slam. And then I think it was David Law from the Tennis Podcast, he mentioned... you know, for me, it would be really disappointing if Yannick doesn't back it up the same way Djokovic did in 2011, winning Indian Wells right after. But that is more the exception than the norm. I think I put out the stat. I think the last player outside the big three to win the subsequent big title after a slam was Andre Agassi. Was it in 2002 or 2001? One of those years, after he won the Australian, I don't remember which year was it. He won Indian Wells or after the Australian Open. So that's more the exception than the norm. So why do we have these lofty standards for every? I mean, it's not like every player has to have the exact same trajectory to greatness, right? I mean, winning a Grand Slam is like a huge box ticked off for most players. I mean, that's one of the biggest goals, or probably the biggest goal for any player who wants to turn pro. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially right now with the way that the Australian Open courts play, there's definitely more of a direct correlation with Miami rather than Indian Wells. I don't really see any reason why Sinner would have to win this title. You know, he was one of the main contenders. Obviously, he was kind of unstoppable. Even for a set in the semifinals, he looked kind of unstoppable. We'll probably touch on, you know, sort of what happened there in a second. But yeah, when it comes to the comparisons, I did not annoy me in any way. They did not really impact me in any way, because it just never felt like a real possibility to me that he will go 40 wins in a row. And that's mostly because even if he won Indian Wells in Miami, I just didn't buy him going unbeaten on clay like Djokovic did all the way until Paris. Like, it just never felt like an option. And that's why I never bothered with these comparisons. I'm not saying that Sinner will definitely suck on clay or something. Like, it's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying it's very hard for him to imagine me. It's very hard for me to imagine him winning Monte Carlo, Madrid, Rome, and Paris, and go to the semis in Paris. True. Like, yeah, that's probably not happening. I mean, he's going to have a loss or two somewhere there, and perhaps he's not even going to win any title, and that's also going to be fine. That's not the part of the season where we are expecting him to be at his strongest. So he kind of has more to gain, I would even say, in the clay season than to lose. And it was kind of the similar for me, actually, in Indian Wells. Like, despite him being on this great streak, and of course, you'd never want it to end, and like, you know, it would be cool if it continues story-wise, but I just kind of felt like in the semifinals against Alcaraz, he doesn't have much to lose because, well, he won the Australian Open. Who cares if he wins Indian Wells, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas for Carlos, it was like a do-or-die situation because of how their matchup has been progressing, how, like, for the past 6 months or so, he hasn't been close to Sinner, he hasn't been close to Djokovic, even to Medvedev results-wise, he hasn't been close, despite winning their only encounter post-US Open. So for me, Sinner kind of had nothing to lose in Indian Wells. I'm not saying that really influenced the match in any way, but that makes absolutely zero sense, what David Law says.
Producer says no mention of the bees. I guess, yeah, in that match against Zverev, probably the bees were more of a threat to Carlos than Zverev himself was. Yeah, post-Sinner?
Wait. Yeah, I mean, he wanted to
right, yeah, of course. I mean, Sinner wasn't there. Anyway, yeah, I mean, again, could be a superhero origin story as well. I mean, you always get bitten by an insect, always. More often than not, I guess. But I don't think Carlos needs that. He's already, I mean, raised himself to superhero status in a way. But with Sinner, yeah, I don't know what it was that he threw up in that bin in Beijing. But, that is something that's to be studied in the future. Anyway, I think we touched up enough maybe on Alcaraz and Sinner. Of course, Casper Ruud and Holger Rune.
I think we could maybe talk about the match as well for a second. I think it's good progress for Alcaraz as well, because of course he kind of struggles to when he's been getting out hit in the past, and he definitely has been against Sinner. Like, this is the matchup where he was struggling to neutralize the violent hitting that Jannik provides, and also the fact that in the past we sort of considered it a problem matchup for him. It can't really be that anymore because they are now both in the galactic status and stuff. But right now it's just a tight match between two evenly contested, a tight rivalry between two evenly matched players. But it is a thing that especially in faster conditions, he might just get rushed to the forehand side. And sometimes for Alcaraz, it's going to be the sort of natural response for him to just try to go blow for blow with that player, just try to outhit them. And courts like this, when he has just a tiny bit more space, that match was definitely a great depiction that, he just doesn't have to do that. He is the player who has like more options in his toolbox, and he was able to really bring that up in the second set. Still, that set will probably not be remembered for for being as close as it was. You know, the two break points that he had to save for 2 and 5-3. These were like proper crucial points in that match. And obviously, especially the 5-3 one is actually going to be sort of among the highlights and stuff. The backhand down the line that he makes there, very low margin, just touches the line. Probably the most important shot of the match. But like all in all, yeah, he actually managed to like start not trying to blast through Sinner, but add a little bit more loop, play the backhand slice to Jannik's backhand and try to set up his forehand with that. Try to just create more forehand openings for himself instead of just trying to blast through the court. And that is really good progress for Alcaraz. That is really something that he can use towards the clay season. Because like if we're just talking, quality on the shots, it's very hard to top Sinner at the moment. Like Sinner just kind of has everyone beaten in serve, return, forehand, backhand. Obviously, forehand of Alcaraz is like kind of comparable. They have different strengths on it. But, it's not something that Alcaraz can really do with Sinner anymore. Just go literally shot for shot with him. And this time at Indian Wells, he was actually adjusting really well the whole week, honestly. Which kind of just, I don't know if it's impressive or if it just shows you that, yeah, he is absolutely like on a court like this, he's going to have a tiny bit more time and he actually becomes a very good problem solver, which is a big difference to like Australian Open and how he played in this very quarterfinal. And I guess even a great example of that is obviously their match here and how different these two were and how simply like a much more mature version of Alcaraz's game we can see on a court like this. But yeah, going forwards, this is a massively important win for him. Because if he loses to Sinner here, like 6-1, 6-3, let's say, if he gets blitzed by Sinner here, I don't really know how he beats him the next time around. But now he's kind of going to know what to do when they face each other on clay, at least. If they play in Miami, I would probably still favor Sinner a little bit. But
Miami,
of course, it will be pretty close. Reports. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But on clay, he's now going to know. Of course, Sinner might also come up with some other ideas, a new recipe for the matchup, right? Which is what is exciting about this one. Like, this is probably the best thing about the rivalry so far, that it's been so back and forth. Whether it's 4-all or 5-4 Alcaraz, kind of leave that to you guys to decide whether.
Yeah, I mean, it's progressing like a tiebreaker. I mean, Alcaraz won the first match, and then the other player is winning two in a row subsequently. Alternating two wins in a row. So yeah, at the moment it's 4-4. So if it were to progress, logically speaking, I guess
5-4. Yeah, it's 5-4.
5-4 Alcaraz. Anyway, yeah, that, again, trying to trace back to you know, the origin story, if you will, of this rivalry. I think what captivated people before that, they played the first time Bercy. I don't think too many people took notice because at that time, okay, yes, Sinner made it to Turin as an alternate, but anyone, Washington, not the strongest field, but yeah, again, he was, his rise wasn't as metronomic as Alcaraz's was in such a short span of time as well. Sinner was just there. Yeah, thanks for pulling that up, producer. Anyway, so it was just, he was there for a while, struggling with his own matchup issues, if you will, against various players, his own health issues. Then there was Alcaraz, of course, but, you know, their matchup is so close. And I think where it began until then, I would say what actually caught people's attention was, okay, these are, you know, two of the biggest next-gen stars that we have. So anytime you have two next-gen players, you know, sort of forming a rivalry, playing each other multiple times, it's going to draw people's attention. But in terms of tennis, it's almost... Okay, yeah, I know that our producer's buzzing about that win, of course.
FA Cup, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm going to say. FA Cup.
Yeah, stopping Liverpool's potential quadruple or whatever.
What was it? Galatasaray, Copenhagen in the Champions League? Yeah, that's what I'm going to say.
Shade. Anyway, as a Chelsea fan, I really shouldn't say anything. But yeah, so basically, as I was saying, I think the US Open match where, you know, they played that amazing 5 hour, 14 minute or whatever, five setter. That is when people thought, okay, you know, in terms of not only in terms of their careers, but in terms of the matchup, this is something, this is probably going to be the rivalry of the decade. And it's so far living up to it. I mean, there's at least one set in every match they've played, at least since, where, you know, we've had some electric tennis from both. Obvious point of the season last year being in Miami, that rally, and you know, of course, like I said, it's lived up to it, and which is nice to see. And tennis TV is doing a good job of marketing this rivalry as well. Ice versus fire, however they want to go. But anyway, I guess we spoke enough about Sinner and Alcaraz. Anything else you want to touch up in terms of matchup dynamics? Or... All right. So yeah, I guess Casper Ruud, again, more wins on hard courts already this season than he did throughout 2023. The most we can do at the moment for Casper is be happy for him that he's racking up wins and he's making it to the final rounds. I don't want to say the final, but final rounds and final eight onwards, I would consider final rounds, of course. Yeah, well, I think there was a bit of a missed opportunity against Tommy Paul in the quarterfinal to, you know, get to at least the semifinal here at Indian Wells. But, you know, making back-to-back finals in Los Cabos, Acapulco, he's a former finalist in Miami. So I just wonder how that bodes for him in terms of, again, we can't really say much without the draw, but at least in terms of form, Casper is somebody who, when he's playing good tennis, he tends to continue on that trajectory for some time at least. And also last year, he's probably played some of his best tennis when we were expecting nothing from him. I mean, he was playing pretty badly until Rome. He makes the semis, makes the final at RG. Even Turin in 2022, I don't know, he makes the final. I don't think people were expecting that after the US Open, where he was losing consecutively early on. So I just wonder if this is the year when he finally breaks that rut of just winning 250s and mostly winning titles on clay. Does he make that breakthrough? But of course, there are glaring issues for him in terms of his records against what, the top 10 currently. I don't even know if he has a top 5 win, does he? I mean, he does. The top 3 win. I don't think he's won a set against the top 3 in his career.
Tough question. I mean, he has one top 10 win at Slams that I remember.
Yeah, that's Holger. And of course, he's beaten Zverev at Miami, Tsitsipas in Madrid.
Tsitsipas, I guess, was like fourth maybe at the time, right?
Yeah, he was not three for sure. Berrettini, of course, Rome in 2020. I think Berrettini was top 10 then.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, top 10, he's got a lot, definitely.
Yeah, but higher top up. Three, not a set one, that's got a sting. I mean, there's just so much scar tissue and baggage he has going into these matches. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely kind of lacking quality in these matches. I mean, there's no real way to...
Went straight there, huh? Yeah.
I mean, well, there's no real way to talk about it in a different way, you know. That's also why he hasn't won a title on the biggest stages, despite getting to the final many times. He's getting outplayed in these finals. It's obviously still fine. Like, the patch that he's had recently, Los Cabos, Acapulco, Indian Wells, yeah, the only thing we can really regret is not getting a title despite being in two finals, and also the fact that he played, here, Tommy Paul in the quarters, Medvedev on this court in the semis. Like, it is a bigger opportunity. Maybe we saw some of that already as he was playing against Gael Monfils in the fourth round, and like for a set, almost two sets, really, he had zero confidence in his forehand, so maybe that was also getting to him. Sort of the opportunity that was ahead of him. But yeah, all in all, it's obviously much better than what he was doing at the at this stage last year, basically. Still, there's going to be a lot of pressure on him at Roland Garros because like about a third of his points come from that one event, right? So he loses that and he is more or less around Tommy Paul, Ben Shelton in the rankings right now, which isn't horrible. Like it's still deep inside the top 20. And it's really going to be all about Paris, kind of, and whether he can defend that here and there, and whether he can maybe just snag, I don't know, half of these points, make the semis, make the quarters, which would really help him out. But yeah, right now he is eighth. There is a pretty big gap in the rankings between the top six and the rest. And you know, he kind of takes advantage of that, but with the way that he's been playing this year, you also kind of have to say that, yeah, I mean, he deserves a top 10 spot at the moment. He's definitely been one of the best top 10 players of the season so far.
For sure. And to answer a question from the producer, yeah, he beat Felix and Fritz in the round robin. I think Fritz was the deciding set tiebreaker and then lost to Rafa. But, you know, that match only would have mattered for him to finish number two in the world. But otherwise, I mean, it was a dead rubber. And yeah, he beat Rublev in the semis. Of course, didn't qualify last year. And I personally thought maybe that was better for him to, you know, regroup and start afresh this season. Because, I mean, he was all over the place last season. Aside from two tournaments that really stood out, RG and Rome. And I can't think of another one, to be very honest. He was below mediocre also, I would say. I mean, I don't even know if he made... Yeah, second round exit at each of the other slams. That's not good. This year, also, we thought, okay, we didn't know what to expect. Loses third round to Nori. Guess that's not as bad as his defeats last year. But what, Brooksby, Brody... Ah, yeah, Brody. Liam Bro, yeah, he had a bit of a run at Wimbledon, making
friend of the show.
Yeah, exactly. I think he got bageled in the fifth set, so that maybe would have been disappointing for him.
No, it's not gonna be disappointing for him because Casper just doesn't care about Wimbledon.
He hates grass, he said it himself many times,
and he clearly doesn't bother. Like, he clearly doesn't bother. So I don't think he can be disappointed if that happens because, well, he just didn't put his mind to it, really.
Okay, fair enough. But US Open, Huli lost to Zhang, I think. Again, bagel.
Yeah, Zhang. Bagel on the fifth. That's kind of also getting out qualitied.
of course. But, yeah, I guess what you're alluding to is that when in a lot of these matches, when, you know, the opponent is bring a higher level, doesn't have much of an answer. Which maybe he got out of jail against Monfils. maybe he got out of jail against Monfils. He played well in a tiebreaker, honestly. But of course, Monfils had chances, I think, to serve for the match. A couple of break points here and there. Anyway, again, like I said, talk about the improvements that he's made this season, results-wise. I don't know, tennis-wise, if he's really changed anything. He's just playing the same game. But anyway, just something to say, of course. Made the quarters. I think that's pretty good still. Would have liked to at least make the semis. But
yeah, he actually never had any decent results in Indian Wells before, which was very surprising to me.
Yeah, first quarterfinal.
Yeah.
And yeah, 2021 was a chance, but I think he was pretty tired after all of those titles before the US Open, and I think even San Diego before Indian Wells, and then there was Labor Cup.
Oh, the fifth slam, San Diego.
Yeah, fifth slam. Right. Of course, according to Vansh, at least.
Yeah,
good to know that both co-hosts of the Iga and Carlo show.
No. I don't care about San Diego. It's just a Vansh joke. No.
Yeah. Of course. Anyway, I guess the stonks, if you will, of your show has risen after this week. You know, both players lifting titles. But,
Holger? We took over the entire tennis landscape, yes.
Right. Holger, I don't really want to talk about the whole incident at the net. I think we know what happened. But tennis-wise, I think he's showing some better results since bringing back Muratoglu. So maybe that's the combination that works for him, because it was all over the place, the coaching situation. He brings in Becker. I think, funnily, when he brought in Becker, that's when he started to play some really good tennis in Bercy and Turin. Then he brings in Serin Luthi. Again, he's losing it early everywhere. Then he lets go of both of them. And yeah, now he's back with Muratoglu. Has some good results in Acapulco semis, quarters here. I would say both are pretty good. Losing to Casper, a player who has dominated the head-to-head. And of course, it's Medvedev, just a better player on hard court at the moment, at least. Thoughts on Holger, and you know, do you like what you're seeing since he's brought back?
Patrick? Yeah, sure. I mean, it's all about whether he can contend for big titles again by the clay. But this is definitely progress. I think I don't know if it's Muratoglu doing the work, sort of, if you may, but it could be just the fact that he needed someone like stability, someone who will be there for him every event, which is something that Becker and that Luthi, they weren't able to give him. And all that mess that he's had, obviously previously working for Lars Christensen, but then after that, Muratoglu joins, Muratoglu leaves, then Christensen's back, then you have Becker and you have Luthi and stuff. And yeah, it just can't really be good for a player who was kind of lost anyway without that, who was kind of lost for a few months. So I think, just having someone there who's going to be there and having to worry about that anymore, that would be huge. I think that might be influencing his results. Obviously, this is a little early still, but at least provided that he's going to be, you know, relatively healthy and yeah, that he's going to be able to focus on his tennis, I would expect him to be, you know, yeah, I don't know, content for 1,000 on clay this year. Like that would be a very good result. That would be just getting back to where he was in 2023. As for the Medvedev loss, I was a little disappointed with how, well, I don't want to say how flat it was. We also need to remember that against Taylor Fritz, he easily could have lost 2-6, 4-5. And then we have like a very different outlook on this run as a whole if he doesn't. If he doesn't claim that much. Casper, to me, is like a bit of a fictional problem for him, because a lot of their matches happened back in the day or like where with physical issues. So here as well, right, in Acapulco, like the third set, Rune is just unable to play anymore and he just starts blasting the ball, almost wins it. I'm not saying he would have won it if he was fit, because that would be like a completely different match then. Like he comes out with a completely different play style there in that third set, if he's healthy, if he's ready to go 100%. So I'm not saying he would have won, but it would have been a very different match. So, you know, there are still concerns, but to make the Indian Wells quarterfinal here, this is better than what he was doing last year during the Sunshine Double. And after that, he had a brilliant clay season. So that's kind of, I think, the hope for Rune right now. Some people say, I think our producer has been saying that, like, he kind of will want to catch Alcaraz and Sinner, which in a way, you know, could work. We need to remember that he's just 20. Maybe he isn't on the trajectory that Alcaraz is right now. But, you know, compared to Sinner at the age of 20, he probably has better results even, or maybe at least used to have better results, like has more trophies, has more big profile stuff in his cabinet. So, I mean, there's every chance, in my opinion, for Holger to return to that level, to threaten the guys again. I would love to see more matches between them. Because obviously, at Wimbledon, he was not that close to Alcaraz in that grass quarterfinal. Then he plays Sinner, I guess, at the ATP finals, right? But, you know, by that point, we've got Sinner in just championship form all the way.
He was also pretty close, wasn't he? He had breakpoint to serve for the match in that.
Yeah, but that was the third match, and it was the, you know, kind of tough to know how invested Sinner is as well, right? So
yeah, that's true, because
I would love to see more matches between them. I would love to see more matches. Yeah, he was already through. So I would love to see more matches between them, basically. And I definitely always remember that Rune Sinner Monte Carlo semi last year, which was fabulous. I really want a match like this pretty soon against either Alcaraz or Sinner for Rune.
Yeah, some interesting comments. I mean, Sean says Holger is the Djokovic of the new three. Big chip on his shoulder. I think at this point, it's just drawing parallels for the heck of it. People want a new big three. They're like, okay, this guy is going to be the Novak. I mean, I know people say that for fun because in a way, yeah, Holger is sort of the disruptor or the one who has had probably more moments on the court than the other two. So yeah, in that way, I get it. And also, of course, in terms of being ambitious and, you know, just like caring so much about the sport and wanting to win. Yeah, I see this.
Probably about the villainous aspect of it, right?
Also, yeah, I was going to get to that. Yeah, villainous, yeah, maybe. But the thing is, like, yeah, Holger, yeah, I've seen him on the court, but then also seeing the other side of his personality, I just can't perceive this guy to be a villain, you know? Like, if you see him on Twitter, or if you just see him, you know, outside interactions outside the court, you know, he just seems like
some claim that it's his mother doing all the Twitter work, that like literally every tweet is from his mother. I don't know. I've talked to Holger off the court once, and he was super nice. That's all I'm gonna say. But his mother actually still will, or his mother, I don't know who, because that's kind of disputed, they will still be doing Twitter despite the IMG contract. IMG will not be interfering with that. That's at least what he said on Twitter, again, or his mother. So,
He replied to Bunch saying that, you know, sometimes when he was on a long flight to Mexico. So then, yeah, he had control of his Twitter. And that is why, because he replied to one of somebody's tweets, you know, a tweet stating, oh, be careful with what Patrick gives you, you know, in light of what happened with Simona Halep. And he said, don't worry, my mom takes care of all of that. And obviously Vansh quoted that and he said, you know, we'll miss tweets like this when IMG takes over. That's when Holger said, yeah, this is what I don't know more. But anyway, yeah, I do agree with what you said. A few other questions. Is Iga your favorite WTA? At the moment, I don't have a favorite on the WTA tour. I mean, I was a huge supporter, if you will, of Muguruza and Osaka back in the day. I mean, before that, I think I had a preference towards players like Azarenka and Kvitova. So yeah, I've not really had a WTA favorite person, you know, if you will. But yeah, I mean, in terms of current players, I would say I'm sort of leaning more to someone like Sabalenka, maybe. But I mean, I respect Iga. You know, a whole lot. You know, to have the career that she's had already before turning, before turning, she's 22 or 23?
22. 2001 born.
All right. So before turning 23, again, like, you know, Hall of Famer career already. So that's amazing. And she's only going to, you know, progress at an exponential rate, I think. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for that. For sure. And she's really fun to watch also. I mean, contrary to a lot of opinions that say, oh, her matches are so decisive, so one-sided. I do, having watched her live multiple times, like seeing the body of work that goes into her game and, you know, the way she goes about things on the court. I really admire that for sure. One more question, then we get back to our chat. Are you excited for Sumit? Is he lined up? Is he lined up to play a challenger anytime soon, do you think?
Miami, right?
Do you have an idea? Oh, he's playing Miami, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he should be able to. Or is he getting a wild card?
Qualifying. He plays Gabriel Diallo in the opening round.
Ah, okay. He's in the qualifying round. Okay. So, yeah, he played Dubai and lost to Sonego in three sets. I'm happy that he's cracked the top 100, but I'll have to see more because he's played these matches. He played Roger Federer, of course, once at the US Open. He's played a few of these matches, but just runs out of gas at some point. And, you know, it's something for him to maybe work on. But, yeah, again, I'll have to see more. But it is pretty nice for him to, you know, knowing what his stories have been like, you know, in terms of struggling on the tour. Yeah, it's good to see him making it to the big time. Any more? I'm thinking of some matches, like standout matches on the at Indian Wells that we may have not talked about, which were pretty fascinating, or some players, if you will.
Yeah, I have to look at the draw.
Always. Yeah, we just have to go back to the draw, like 96 players, and see which matches. Okay, I off the top of my head, a couple of players who I think we kind of expected them to
go. Oh, Lehechka, we should talk about.
Yeah, of course.
I think Lehechka is the main story, really, that we haven't touched on.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh, so should I just start? Okay, yeah. So, of course, for Lehechka to go back-to-back against Rublev and Tsitsipas like this, it is pretty huge. I think this was more impressive than the Australian Open quarterfinal. He did feel a lot more unstoppable, I would say. Of course, he had a pretty good match against Felix in Australia, but it was also Felix. This one seemed bigger. The way he was just out baselining Rublev, especially the way he just had more on every shot, was more dynamic out of the corners, was serving extremely well. It's huge. Of course, as every single time with Lehechka, we're going to sort of circle back to the question of repeatability, whether he can do it all the time, because even with all the improvements and like how much he's gotten his transition game to be a thing, yeah, sure. But he also has, you know, patches of really poor losses. You know, he almost goes out to David Goffin in Marseille, but somehow wins, loses to Rinderknecht. Well, the one to Mikkelsen at the Australian Open, I think, was a big disappointment for him as well, even though he was coming off a title. But yeah, I mean, if we just look at it sort of in a vacuum this year, I mean, he's got an ATP 1000 quarterfinal. He's got a title in Adelaide. He's made an ATP title. So yeah, it is good progress. Maybe this year will actually be the 2023 of Lehechka that we were envisioning, because after January and February, obviously in 2023, everyone was like screaming that this is probably the year where Lehechka makes the top 20, top 15. Maybe this was just delayed by a year. But yeah, I do think that he's a performer that definitely deserved to be mentioned here. Didn't come close to Sinner, but you know, who the hell can right now? Like Sinner, that was one of these matches where Sinner just looks unplayable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wanted to go back to that, of course. Steph, the way he played against Tsitsipas, it felt like Berdych took to court and beat Tsitsipas. Like, it was so similar in terms of, I mean, the spot serving and also, like, serving's way out of trouble. Nolan, come on, he's won, like, five of them.
Yeah, Canada, Rome, Madrid. Yeah, like, Madrid, five of them.
Madrid twice, Cincy. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Five of them. Anyway, coming back to the way he was, I mean, finding the lines from wherever he was on the court and, you know, just belting forehands and backhands, and they were catching the line. It was finding the angles when he needed to. His net game was pretty good. Serve, you know, needless to be said.
Yeah. I mean, sure, Berdych now in his team, so he sits there and watches Lehechka. This has been like someone that he was compared to early on in Czechia. You know, they were looking at Lehechka as like a potential future Berdych. Yeah, you're back now. They were looking in Czechia for Lehechka to be like a potential future Berdych. So it's pretty cool that they're working with one another right now. Obviously, there are differences. Berdych was so much taller, was definitely a lot more stiff athletically. I don't know who has more potential. I think Menchik out of the two, out of Lehechka and Berdych.
Yeah, Berdych is sort of more lanky as well. Lehechka's heavier built, I guess.
Legs-wise, yeah, sure. So it's hard to compare them. But that was a real breakthrough, I think, to me, that Indian Wells run. We'll see how it goes. Obviously, he's not going to be like close to Sinner Alcaraz anytime soon, but he definitely could be part of the, let's say, I don't know, top 20. It's not like his peak game is there. His peak game is top 20 for sure. But yeah, now we're just going to have to see whether he actually repeats that. And Miami, if anything, like, it's also a very good card for him. So
yeah,
it's going to be open depending on the draw, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was, I guess, a good roundup on, you know, Lehechka and his tournament. Yeah, one more thing I wanted to say. I didn't watch his match against Rublev, but of course, yeah, Lehechka, and then maybe a word on Tsitsipas, since obviously we're like scraping the bottom barrel here to look for stories to talk about to round up Indian Wells. Yeah, before that, we'll maybe look into Miami. It's no secret how much he's been struggling against top 15 over the past year. I think you probably will agree, but again, you know, I'll ask you for your opinion on this. I think unless he does something about that backhand, he's just going to keep getting exposed by a half-decent player even. Because Lehechka is someone, he had a 2-0 lead going into the match against. And for that to happen.
But like Lehechka, you know, they played 2022 Rotterdam was the very first event where like Lehechka, you know, has a proper main tour run. He breaks the top 100 with that run to the semis in Rotterdam. Like, we cannot really say it like this, like, you know, Tsitsipas had a big lead over Lehechka, because of course Lehechka is a lot younger and like he's just getting more and more dominant sort of as the tour progresses, as he's getting better. So I think the head-to-head didn't matter really. Yeah, for sure, it's feeling like Tsitsipas doesn't lose randomly, but he's losing to every single top player and he's losing to every single young player who just has such a clear target really going into that match. They just know exactly what to do. And we're talking about guys like Lehechka, about guys like Fils, who usually actually, you know, they're young. They tend to struggle to exactly like fully understand what to do on the court. And against Tsitsipas, they just have, you know, massive game plans, like a highway for them. You know, they just get out there, they blast the gas pedal and they never let go. And for Steph, obviously, this is a pretty horrible prediction for the future. You know, this is just him sort of getting passed by not only Alcaraz, Sinner, Rune, but also by the other youngsters by now. And
yeah.
I mean, he's still solid. He still gets pretty deep results. Like,
I don't even know if he's at that solid level, because he's not even making it to the quarter semis, you know, least.
Yeah, but like if you look at who he's losing to, you know, I mean.
Yeah, but the problem is the number of players in that category is just going to keep increasing.
Yep.
And if you are obviously a top player or someone in the top 10, top 15 upper echelons of the rankings, you are expected to beat most players than not. So that is why I mentioned, yeah, you know, his reliability is that, I mean, he's not just stagnated, I feel he's regressed now. But, you know, that could change. I don't know. There's so many coaching changes that have taken place in his team for the worse, of course. And a lot of people say it. I don't know if it's a hit job and his father or whatever, but they say that relationship's not doing any good for him. I mean, every time I tune in to watch a match, there's some courtside analyst. I'm sitting right beside Tsitsipas's box. It's not looking good. There's just so much chatter. It is not going to help Steph. That's all I hear from these people. And yeah, he's had coaches. They've come and gone. So who knows? Right, at least with Holger now, he has Muratoglu back. I was sort of worrying that could be the case with him too and his mother. Turns out, you know, for now things are a bit stable on his end. So yeah, without the Miami draw, is there a whole lot we can talk about it? I don't know, but since anyway, we have a rough idea as to where the top seeds will fall. We know that Sinner and Alcaraz won't play before the final. Medvedev and Zverev won't play before the final, thank God. Right. Because Novak's not there. So Zverev is number four.
Sure. And actually, regardless of the result of the Alcaraz Sinner semi, we also would have had them in separate halves, right? Despite the fact that Carlos saved the number two. Yeah, I mean, I told you guys that before the show began, you know, off the, let's say, off backstage. But basically, I can't be bothered analyzing this draw when it comes out, because it's just too early. Like, you know, there's just been one mammoth event. I don't give a damn in the world about where this guy is going to land. This guy is going to land.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm going to start following it. I mean, yeah, sure. I'm going to watch it as it progresses. Of course, I'm going to watch the qualifying today. It starts in an hour and 42 minutes. Obviously, I'm going to be all over that. I know most of the qualifying draw by heart, but I could not care less about the main draw of the ATP 1000 in Miami. And that's
I'll ask you one question then. There's a certain player is coming back. He was a former finalist in Miami, former top four player. He got a wild card. You can guess who he is, right?
Nishikori.
Yeah. So any thoughts on what it's going to be like for him? He's been away for a really long time. Really, really long time.
I mean, how long? Is it like 6 months or something?
Did he play at all last year?
Of course. He actually broke a record. He came back in Palmas del Mar and he became the first ever player to win a challenger while being unranked. And he managed to get that done in his first event back.
Challenge,
he
also, okay. Yeah, no, I meant
he played a couple tour. More challengers and then he played Atlanta. He lost in the quarters there. Since Atlanta, he has been out. But because of that, we still have zero predictions for him. When he came back last year, he was playing at a very decent standard. Yes, he went like, I don't know, 9-3 or something like that. He lost to Kudla, Fritz, and Mikkelsen, maybe? That was a great match as well against Mikkelsen. Kudla on a very fast, slick court, so it's always acceptable. Yeah, when he played last year, he was great right away. But yeah, we just have no idea, absolutely. What I was going to say as well is that I don't really get all the criticism that Miami gets because of the parking lot stuff and everything. We are watching tennis, you know, all over the world on our couches. Like, why does it matter for you where the event is held? It could be in a cave, you know, and I would be enjoying it. I don't think it really matters like where the stadium is. However, I think Miami does suffer as like the follow-up to Indian Wells. Like that's actually a thing why probably more important and why people sometimes seem a little disinterested in it, because it's just very early. You know, I really couldn't care less about that draw because I just stopped watching Indian Wells, and I'm not really too excited about that one. And I honestly wasn't too excited about analyzing the Indian Wells draw in the first place.
Miami
is even worse. Like Miami is okay. I mean, they will land in some sections, but I don't really think I will be bothered to like think, oh, okay, so this guy will probably make the quarterfinals. This guy will probably make the semis. No, I mean, I'm going to just watch as it unfolds. And that is a thing of two mammoth events like this back to back.
Yeah. Interesting point you brought up. Like, why does it matter where tournament or match is played? But yeah, I mean, having watched Miami Open at Crandon Park for so long, and you know, having seen what the atmosphere, what the vibe is like, I mean, we kind of get a sense from obviously watching on television. Of course, you don't need to actually be there, and you know, the aesthetics in terms of the colors and how the stadium was, you do get an idea. So I am actually with people there. You can tell that, you know, one event follows the other in terms of court aesthetics and how the courts played also. Why it may be exciting is because, say, a player, for example, loses early in Indian Wells, can immediately bounce back in Miami. There's something to look forward to over there. But yeah, at the moment, only because we have 5 of the 9, maybe more to follow, Masters events that are going to be 96-player draws. I don't know what that's going to be like for the sport, for the future of the sport, honestly. And if in any way it could, I'm obviously for players winning a Grand Slam, winning a Grand Slam, but it would be nice to have those events exclusively as 2-week-long events, 10-day, 2-week-long events, whatever, rather than Masters events. But then the separation starts to sort of narrow more amongst the categories, is what I think. And I think also on a lot of 500 events, draws are bigger, and you have the top four seeds getting buys. Not top eight, top four. So
500s? Do we get that for the most
part? I think a few tournaments they do. I think Vienna maybe, or
No, Vienna doesn't have buys. Medvedev had feels in the opening round last year.
Right,
I think Barcelona is the only one, but that's a 48-player draw. But that's a 48-player draw, so it's very different.
Right.
I think 500s don't have buys generally, unless it's a bigger draw than 32.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I guess that it is what it is. Yeah, Barcelona, right, Gene? That's true. Another question from Snehu. Ask that question because I thought you're... Yes, I am Indian, of course. And yeah, I'm happy for Sumit, but I said what I said. I mean, I just hope to see more of him. So, from the matches he's played against the top players, of course, he beat Bublik in the opening round of the Australian Open. We know Bublik can be unserious, so I'm not too surprised by that result. But yeah, like I said, you know, it is what it is. Anything? Wait. How upset? Okay. Oh, wait, the WTA draw is out. Yeah. I was like, wait, what is he talking about? But anyway. So I guess that rounds it up. That's been it. Unless there's something more on your mind, maybe.
I think we can finish right here. Obviously, the previous section of this was a little underdeveloped, but well, it is what it is. Yeah, we can only do as much before the draw is out. So
exactly,
that's kind of where we have to stop it. Anyway, we still.
Yeah, given, I don't know why. What the reason is for having the women's draw come out before the men's?
Because it starts earlier. It starts a day earlier. That used to be the format for both Indian Wells and Miami, but they experimented with this in Indian Wells, and they're now actually going about it a different manner. But Indian Wells qualifying for the women started yesterday already, and it's like, yeah, all day, all one day. At least that's how it used to be. I actually didn't check it, but that makes sense, right? Like, that's... I'm pretty sure that this is the reason. I will just pull it up very quickly. 2024 tournament schedule. I'm already looking at it, but yeah, precisely. I mean, you're gonna have what? Okay, never mind. I misinterpreted something. But yeah, basically, yeah, the women's draw starts a day earlier.
All right, fair enough. So, pleasure having you on as always, Damien. It was a nice chat. Hope to see you at some point along the way in Miami. Hope you find the interest in you to analyze the draw, maybe.
Analyze the draw, no. But to watch the matches, yes. To watch the matches, yeah. I will have it, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we will definitely see some names you're familiar with, of course, on the Challenger Tour who are making it through qualies.
Hopefully, yeah. Today, I'm definitely going to be on the lookout in the qualifying 90 minutes from here. A bit more of a manageable time zone as well. For you as well, probably. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's like 3 hours important. Earlier. Yeah. So that makes a huge difference, of course.
Yeah.
Indian Wells, it's like 11. I think second half of the tournament when they reverted from daylight savings, it was 11 hours. Then before that was 12, a bit brutal. But yeah, this definitely helps. You know, I think the finals definitely watchable there around 9 p.m. or so. So yeah, the final rounds should, you know, they should be doable. Better times, like you said. Brody is injured.
Yeah, he pulled out of Miami qualifying.
Wait, so someone pulls out of qualifying before qualifying is underway. Is there another player who takes up the spot? I mean, you don't call him lucky loser, I guess, but... I guess it's just someone else.
He withdrew like days ago, so it wasn't a thing. The next guy of the list just came in. If someone pulls out right away, last moment, you can have an alternate.
Oh, it's a walkover, yeah. Right?
No, you can still have an alternate.
You can have an alternate. Yeah, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, if it's first round, you can still have an alternate. But of course, someone actually has to be there in order for this alternate. This week you have this Challenger 50 in Merida in Mexico, and there were 8 buys in the first qualifying round. Literally any player with an ATP point could have showed up there, but they didn't.
Interesting. Anyway, so yeah, thanks once again, and yeah, see you soon to cover Miami. And thanks to everyone who was here with us for the stream. Right.
Lance Davis plays, yeah. Instead of Neon Brody, Lance Davis. There's going to be like a tweet from that account, whatever it is, entry list updates or something. Out Brody, in Lance Davis, the president of life. What was it? Killer B life removal. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Shihari. Yeah.
Thank you, Damien. See you soon. Waiting for the...
If you enjoyed this video, make sure you hit that like button. Don't forget to subscribe and click that notification bell so you don't miss out on all things tennis.
Sports Social Podcast Network.